Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we have an interesting show this evening. Our first guest is Donald Schmidt, and he'll be talking about his mentor, J. Allen Hynek. In the second part of the show, we have Alice Druffel. She'll be talking about her noted mother, the ufologist Anne Druffel, and as well as James McDonald. A lot of interesting tidbits about what it was like to grow up in a household where UFOs was always in the background. And you can support the show to listen to the full shows. And all you have to do is go to podcastufo.com and sign up there. Also, you can listen to the full shows live on podcastufo.com at 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can also listen to the full shows on the Dark Matter Digital Network. And that's on Thursdays from 10 to midnight. The show is also on YouTube, the full shows. So anyway, that's it. I do want to dedicate this show, unfortunately, the last day of the International UFO Congress. We lost Craig Lang. He's a MUFON researcher, a great guy, according to many. And unfortunately, he had what he thought was a head cold, but ended up being wheeled out. I saw him go out into the ambulance and unfortunately passed away the next day. So I'd like to dedicate this show to Craig Lang. Other than that, the International UFO Congress was great. Alejandro and I will talk about that next week. So here we are with our first guest, Donald Schmidt. Don Schmidt, welcome to the show once again.
Thank you, Martin. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And it's always fun. As we were just mentioning a little while ago, I think you were one of the first people that I had on my show. Like number four or something like that out of 280, whatever it is.
280. 289,
I think.
So
yeah.
You finally are getting it right. So,
well, trying. As some of the people will know, I've had a few technical difficulties while going live. So I just haven't been able to.
I think the last time I was on with you, your dog was having some difficulty, and then you lost your dog.
Yeah, we lost the dog. Yes, and I got a really nice note from you, and I do remember that. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. So you're here at the Congress to actually talk about J. Allen Hynek, who I think is fascinating. Now, and you knew him pretty well.
Yes, I did, and I miss him. I miss him in the sense that not only was he my mentor, but he became not only a good friend, but he became a bit of a father figure in a field that there are a lot of loners. There are a lot of people that just march to whatever drum they decide. And for me, it created a level, a discipline, in that there were certain parameters that we needed to abide by. And as a result, I saw a level of bravery in him for not only still trying to always remain the consummate scientist, but willing to buck as far as the tide of public opinion. And as a result, I saw that he very often isolated himself. And it was all the more reason that he confided to us. We became, in many ways, his secondary family in that regard. His wife, Mimi, during that time, she was the only one within his own family. He had his own children, but they weren't into the topic at all. And Mimi, even after Alan passed away, she still, she came back to our board of directors. We were so pleased that we quickly renamed the Center for UFO Studies in his honor, and to this day, the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies. And she accompanied us on our first archaeological dig to the Roswell debris field.
Wow.
And she commented a number of times, "Alan would be so proud of you boys." And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that he schooled a whole number of us to carry on, to follow in footsteps, that here was the true father of modern-day ufology. And even as he happened to be at the right place at the right time, having, you know, been the astronomer physicist at Ohio State, just down the road from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and as Project Sign and then Grudge and then the most famous Blue Book was established, that he wasn't even head of the department at that time, but he was the only one who agreed that, well, I'll come on. I'll become your scientific consultant. And he became their chief debunker, so to speak. He was the one who always went before the press and explained away whatever incident, whatever case, you know, had come to their attention at the time.
Do you happen to know what his thoughts were prior to when he actually changed his thoughts? But, I mean, early on, did he just think it was total bunk himself?
Absolutely. He thought, and he often suggested that he felt that this was nothing more than a part of the silly season, as he would call it, that that first major wave of the summer of 1947, that it was the lazy, hazy days of summer, and that people just for want of something to do, that this was going to be a passing phase, and that would be the end of it. And then especially as the phenomenon, the reports escalated, and then even after the tacit dismissal at Roswell, and the reports were squelched, the reports died, but nonetheless the sightings continued. And then with that that big wave in 1952, and he already had been called on to assist with Project Grudge, and then working with the first director of Blue Book, Captain Edward Ruppelt, and he saw that, you know, that they could really make some substantial effort into demonstrating that there was a true phenomenon, yet he still remained quite the skeptic. So it wasn't, this was a gradual change. And long before my involvement, I mean, I wasn't involved with Dr. Hynek until 1978, the last 8 years of his life. But nonetheless, in becoming a student and listening to him, described to us how he would very often interview pilots, both commercial and military. And he would listen to some of the most profound descriptions, you know, of close encounters. Aircraft, you know, airy objects that clearly were not of our technology back in the 50s and 60s. And then week after week or month after month, going from Illinois, from Chicago, Evanston more specifically, down to Dayton, Ohio, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and sifting through all the current reports, and where's this case? Where's that case? I spoke to that SAC officer. Where is that? And they'd act like they didn't know what I was talking about. Hmm. And he said, I saw very early on that they were censoring the reports. And I was getting just the mundane. I was looking through, you know, expecting to see a follow-up on these cases, and they were nowhere to be found. So he says, I realized that all the hardcore cases, as he would put it, were going upstairs, were going elsewhere. Where that was, he had no idea. He had no idea because he was of the impression Blue Book was it. It was the official investigation. And then more and more he realized that all of these people can't be lying. We're talking about PhDs. We're talking about trained professional people that are describing, you know, the same characteristics, the same, you know, flight characteristics that defy conventional explanation. And then the case in Socorro in April of 64, which he immediately, you know, concluded was a physical, was a vehicle. Something actually physically touched down and left those, you know, depressions in the ground and the charred, you know, the sagebrush still at the site.
Creosote brush, yeah.
And then Dexter, Ann Arbor, Michigan. And he got in trouble there with the swamp gas explanation.
Yes.
But as he emphasized to us, but that was only one sighting at that time. And it happened to be a farmer over a marsh, which could very well have been marsh gas, swamp gas.
Yep.
But he got labeled. I mean, and then Congressman Gerald Ford at the time, And I know I'm getting into a lot of things I'm going to be covering in my talk, but nonetheless, it demonstrated not only the human side of what science should be, but the fact that it's that classic line in The Day the Earth Stood Still with the professor Barnhart, who plays almost like the Einstein scientist in the movie. And he's asked, and a comment is made, "You have faith, Dr. Barnhart." And he responds, "It's not faith, it's curiosity that makes good science." And that was Dr. Jalen Hynek. That was one of the things that he always emphasized to us. And that was, never lose that little boy wonderment. That every time you look up at the stars, let your imagination just, you know, go wild. Wow. And I love that about him. And that's why when I said I still miss him, because we're rudderless within the ufology presently. Everybody is allowed to just speak out and say whatever they want to and believe whatever they want to. And there isn't that governing force any longer. That, and maybe it's there and I'm just not seeing it, but with Hynek, and especially for the fact that he went from just total abject debunkery to the point that, and the last time I actually sat down with him, and he went, "Don," and he pounded his fist, he went, "Don, it's smacking more and more of nuts and bolts." And for an astronomer, especially, you know, it's just addressing the distances from planet, you know, point A to B, and just how does another intelligence traverse, you know, as far as Alpha Centauri being 4.3 light years away, our closest star system, and it's just beyond human comprehension. And yet he was willing to comprehend that, to try to deal with that. And those are all the things I loved about him. Because he was not only that human as a scientist, but he was also that genuine. He was still the foremost scientist, but in dealing with something beyond the human pale, beyond our own existence, that he loved to contemplate what was out there. That just because we don't understand it doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
That's right. And, you know, I mean, the phrase of, as far as they can't get there from here, I've heard a few different people say, well, obviously they can.
Obviously, you know, they can.
There's something in physics they have figured out
they've
that we
mastered.
Haven't.
They've precisely.
Yeah.
And so. With Alan, too, with Dr. Hynek, when he was, you know, sitting in the comfort of it, he had his recliner at home, and he had his box of all his remotes. And, you know, it was his master controls. You know, it was almost like his Kirk having his control chair, you know, in the Enterprise, that type of thing. And we'd all sit around him. It was almost like sitting at the foot of the master, so to speak. But then it was basically, speak freely. What do you think? What do you believe about this case or that case? And I remember on one occasion talking about, you know, the Van Allen belt. Just the possibility that had to be a planet or something at one time. And the thought that there may have indeed been another planet between the Earth and Mars. And he would go on. And I thought, well, what if there was indeed intelligent life on Mars at one time? And whatever caused that belt, that planet, to self-destruct, or was it something that you tore it apart, pushed Mars out as far as in a deeper orbit, caused, you know, some type of catastrophic, and some of them were able to evacuate. It wasn't like they were flying to another star system, it was just hopping to the next planet. And they've been here all this time, maybe in underground bases, bomb the ocean, what have you, and they continue to perpetrate the impression that they're from out there, when in reality, they're from right here. And he'd go, "I love it. Huh. I love it."
So he was really open-minded.
Totally. Yeah. Totally.
You know, I'd like to take a little bit of a jag here, and that's kind of a pun intended. And earlier when you and I were talking in the lobby, you told me your story about traveling around with William Shatner.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and when I say JAG, you'll understand the pun. Mm-hmm. Can you tell that story about when you were in that one theater?
Well, first of all, and it was something that even after Dr. Hynek passed away, and Mark Rodiger, who stepped in first as the deputy director of QFOS, and then we had an election, and then he actually became Alan's successor. And we would go to, like, WindyCon in Chicago with the thought, how do we break into the ranks of the science fiction audience? And we finally realized that, well, it's because we're encroaching on their territory. We're essentially making their fiction into nonfiction, and they were threatened by that.
Huh.
And we broached that, and we crossed over that boundary forbidden, you know, area of society that, you know, was in total resistance to ufology. And the next thing I know, I'm approached, I'm doing a lecture in Charlotte, North Carolina, by a gentleman by the name of Rick Starnes, who was president of Starlight International, something like that. He did these Trekoramas, these Star Trek conventions. And he goes, Don, I have an idea. Have you ever done? No, I've never done science fiction. We tried, but he says, I'm interested in doing these two-person conventions. And the next thing I know, I'm doing two-man conventions with Captain Kirk, William Shatner. And the first time I would meet him was just after they filmed the alternative death scene of Captain Kirk in Star Trek Generations. They just filmed it in Death Valley over in Las Vegas.
Fitting.
And I'm invited to step into the back of this limo, and there, Captain Kirk. I couldn't help it. Captain Kirk, you know. Not that I reacted that way, yeah. But it was just amazing for me. And I already had done shows with John DeLancey and George Takei and Jimmy Doohan and Walter Koenig and a few of the others, but this was Captain Kirk. And we spoke at the Coliseum in Lubbock. And I kind of joked about, well, I'm sorry you had to die. And he kind of, Don, they killed me. They killed me. He just kept going on, how'd they kill him? And we would finish at the Coliseum, and we were scheduled to do the San Antonio Theater that evening. So we had to catch a plane from Lubbock into Dallas and then fly into San Antonio. And even through the Dallas airport, he is carrying this huge leather garment bag like a saddle over his shoulder. And Rick Starnes, the producer, and myself, we're trying to keep up with him as we're keeping up a fast pace to get to our gate, and escalators, he's running up the steps, and come on, boys, and everybody, he's wearing his little granny glasses, and everybody's pointing because they recognize, there goes Captain Kirk, So we arrive in San Antonio, and there's a limo waiting for us, and it's for Bill Shatner and myself. And I'm sitting in the back seat with Captain Kirk. And we pull up to the San Antonio Theater. And the people are lined up on both strips of the sidewalk. And Bill's looking out and he's going, look at that, Don. We got a sellout. And I look out my window and I look up and there I see on the marquee of the Alamo Dome, tonight only, the Rolling Stones. And I'm like, Bill. And he looks out, and, oh, no, we're doomed. And he stayed in the green room. He wouldn't come out. He was so sure that, And finally, Rick Starnes, the producer, comes bursting into the room. We got a sellout! 2,500 people, that type of thing. Oh, I knew it, He acted so proud. So I'm up on stage, and typically what we would do is I would do an hour on Roswell. And he would then do an hour, he would tell some wonderful stories, behind the scenes,
of
Star Trek.
Stuff.
And even T.J. Hooker and all the questions, like Heather Thomas and that type of thing. And I don't want to go into any details there, but I loved it. I loved it. But it was just before our Roswell movie came out. So I even had some trailers that I was showing for the upcoming Showtime movie.
Yep.
But if you've ever been up on stage and all the stage lights, you can't see beyond the first few rows.
Yeah.
But out of the corner of my eye, I see sitting at the end of the front row, just sitting there beaming up at me, and there's Bill Shatner. just smiling like, Don, we did it. And later, we're backstage, and a stagehand comes running up. Mr. Shatner, where were you? We were looking for you. We were trying to find you. And he goes, well, I was out in the audience. I was listening to Don. He says, well, you'll never guess who was backstage wanting to meet you. Well, who? The mayor? No, Mick Jagger. While Shatner was in the front row, Mick Jagger was pacing back and forth behind the curtain, separating the two of us, right behind me. So I was sandwiched between Mick Jagger and Bill Shatner while I was giving a talk on Roswell.
That's an awesome story.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. That's great. So I know we went off of J. Allen Hynek quite a bit, but I wanted to hear that story.
But Hynek loved celebrity. I mean, we're doing Close Encounters and with Spielberg, and he didn't get along with Richard Dreyfuss. You might know, Martin, that originally Spielberg, they tried to do the movie without Dr. Hynek. They thought
you mean without his advice?
Without his involvement, without his advice. The fact
but he's the one who coined the phrase.
Precisely. In his book, UFO Experience.
Yeah.
And then I think it was partly because the legal department said, well, we may need to get permission. So that's when he invited Alan on to the set. And
it's a good decision.
It was a good decision. Yeah. But and then that wonderful cameo at the end on Devil's
Did you
Tower.
Know him during that time?
Actually? No, no. It was just before.
Just before.
Just before. Yeah. But I did have the opportunity of after he went to the premiere, and then we were all back at the residence back in Evanston, Illinois, and we were sitting there after dinner that evening, and I went, so Alan, I suppose now Close Encounters is your favorite UFO movie. And he went, no, it's still The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Oh, really? Isn't that something?
And it was. It remained The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Now,
which
when
is
was
my,
that, 1951?
1951. Wow. Michael Rennie, certainly, and the Gort the Robot. And just.
So did he actually see it during when it was out then, and he was actually involved in the UFO topic at the time when that movie came out, or was that after? I'm trying to think.
It would have been shortly thereafter because he was on the tail end of Grudge, which was 51, and then Blue Book in 52, Fall 52.
Yeah.
So, but then remembering that he came in as a complete skeptic. So I don't recall that he ever mentioned having seen the film until it actually premiered on television. I remember it premiered on NBC Saturday Night Movies.
Really?
Scared me to death. That rope, I mean,
I
Gort.
Saw it. Yeah. I saw it young, and it scared me, too. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Woke up many a night with that robot stepping into the bedroom doorway and seeing that shield lift.
Very, very cold. That's what I remember. Now, did Hynek actually remember hearing about the Roswell incident when it happened? Because that just went away, and nobody remembered it. But he actually remembered it when it first happened.
He only became, from all indication, when I was there, when I would watch, and if you remember who the true father of the crash retrieval, and people would always think it's Stan Friedman. It actually was the late Len Stringfield.
Yep.
When he did that talk at the MUFON Symposium in Dayton, what better place, Dayton, Ohio. And Len, at the time, lived in Cincinnati. Len didn't like to fly. So that was one of the reasons that it attracted him, that he could just drive right over to Dayton from Cincinnati. And that was in July of 78. And so it was the first time that he presented, his retrievals of the third kind.
Hmm.
And he got into the whole, as far as, possibility that there have been crashes. And he was developing, this roster of all these sources, all these leads, anonymous, as it turns, as it sadly always remained, that he had all these leads of all these potential crashes. One of them was Roswell, because he was one of the first people to talk to Major Jesse Marcel, the intelligence officer from Roswell.
Wow.
And that was Hynek's first contact with even, that possibility that there have been some retrieval cases. And Allen spent the better part of the next few years trying to get Len Stringfield to open his files. And I'll never forget when we had the QFOS conference at the Midland Hotel in Chicago. And Allen, Dr. Hynek, spent all this time meeting with Stringfield in his room, in his private room. And we waited outside in the hallway. And never forget how Allen walked out, and all he kept saying was, "I feel so sorry for you, Len. I feel so sorry for you." Because Allen struck out. Wow. That he couldn't get him to break his promise of confidentiality.
Wow.
He was that honorable, that principled a man. And he also felt that it allowed him to remain a magnet, that people could then go to him with such confidence, that he wasn't going to betray that confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And Allen tried, and he failed. And yet after Dr. Hynek passed away, and if you remember that when Allen he came here to Scottsdale, he retired here because he had been promised all types of money as far as research funding, and which never came to fruition. But he left. He still remained scientific director at QFOS, but we felt detached. We felt as though he had even abandoned us to some degree, because we weren't hearing anything from the Hynek's any longer. And he was willed, when he had retired from Northwestern University, an old abandoned observatory in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, of all places.
Wow.
So the hope was that he and our chief investigator at the time, who was Alan Hendry, and Alan was more of a tech writer, a technical writer, who would leave QFOS, and he became a tech writer at Hughes Aircraft in Tucson. I would even stay with Alan on one occasion, I had a speaking engagement in Tucson. But he and his wife, Elaine, and Elaine was a former student of Alan's, and she was the astronomer in their family. So it was Elaine who followed Alan to Scottsdale after the Hendry split. So the plan was that Alan was going to invite her to assist him in rebuilding this abandoned observatory, and then she was going to run it. But little did we know that Alan was also going over to Corona, New Mexico. So after he passed away, we found all these handwritten notes. He was interviewing the ranchers and the families out in the Corona area where the crash originally took place in 1947. He was following up on this.
Wow.
And at the top, this needs to be followed up on. So he was investigating Roswell. We had no idea.
Wow.
So
did those notes in your investigation, did those notes help you in any type of way?
It corroborated.
Yep.
With people that we then, a few years later, actually interviewed ourselves for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the point being, if they impressed Alan well enough, well, they also impressed us. And in a similar situation where I went into Roswell as a complete skeptic, the point being that as Alan went into the subject as a complete skeptic, and we both made the 180, that the evidence. And I think that's what he was also talking about, and not losing the little boy wonderment, because Alan hated to be behind a desk. He loved being in the field. We talk about whether it was being hoisted up on their shoulders after the plane landed in Papua New Guinea to investigate, to follow up on the Father Gill case.
Yeah.
Or as far as Hess Dahlen up towards the Arctic Circle. And Alan, you know, trudging through all that snow. I mean, he was 70 years old at that time and knee-deep snow. And all he came home with was a bad cold from that situation. I remember driving him around in Evanston, sitting next to me, just sneezing and coughing like crazy.
Wow.
And feeling so proud that there he was, still leading the charge.
Wow. Let's go back quickly to the Father Gill case. That's such a fascinating case.
Oh, absolutely.
What was his conclusion on that? Did he come to some type of conclusion?
You have to remember that Dr. Hynek didn't investigate the Gill incident as a consultant to the Air Force. It was years later.
I see.
And then even when Father Gill came to America, and then he stayed, he spent time at the Hynek residence. And Alan, you know, spent all that additional time with him. Alan was totally convinced, totally impressed with the Gill case.
For the person that doesn't know this amazing case with the flashlight or whatever it was, everything, the beings on top of the craft and waving and all that.
Was it 57 or 58?
Yeah.
I know it's at a time just around Sputnik, but nonetheless, it was where two nights as far as apart, a low hovering craft. And the first night where the object just, remained stationary, hovering over that particular mission in Papua New Guinea. Father William Gill was the head of the mission at that time. And then the next night, almost an identical situation. And this time, the people observed people.
Right.
As though they were attending this something almost like on a catwalk on a platform, a flying platform. And the natives were waving.
Yep.
And much to their surprise, the occupants were waving back down. And Father Gill would go to what they called, you know, a torch, which was a flashlight.
Yeah.
And he would flash it, and the object would teeter.
That's,
you know, in the
happened,
motion of as far as the flashlight, as they would wave it.
Yeah, yeah.
And
amazing.
It was precise, and especially because these people were all virgin, untainted. They had no prior knowledge of the subject, and they described exactly what they saw. Their sketches were a classic, you know, flying saucer.
I love the video of him being interviewed about this. And at the very end, he says, well, it happened, you know, whether you can believe me or not, you know, and it's okay if you don't believe me, but I know it happened.
But I know
like
it happened.
Yeah.
Right. And don't you love that as far as that? I mean, everyone, it's almost like it was a Patrick Moynihan. It was a great Democratic as far as senator. And he would always make the comment, you're entitled to your own opinion, but not your own facts. And as a result, you know, yeah, you can believe what you want, but I know what happened.
Yeah. Well, while we're on the subject of facts, I just want to take another little jag here, and that is the Roswell slide fallout.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about, now how many years, is that like two years now? And
it's was now, May 5th? May will be 3 years. May will be 3 years.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how has that fallout been for you?
The fallout has been another revelation, another education as far as in the life of Don Schmidt, in the notion that not being a scientist and having to rely on professional people in performing due diligence, and at the time working with anthropologists and forensic experts, pathologists, who you wouldn't expect would know their fields, would know when you show them something, now what does this look like to you? And then after being allowed to even study and do almost short of actually having a cadaver, you know, a forensic report on based on what you see within this figure, this image contained within this slide, what is your best professional estimate or consensus of what we're looking at here? And so what I learned above everything else is that even science is very unabsolute. that even when that science is not a field of consensus, that you can have a whole group of people sitting here, and just because, well, you believe something to be factual, it's still a belief until you are able to demonstrate beyond a shadow of a doubt. And so I learned, for example, that just with a slide, just with a photographic image, that no matter that Eastman Kodak determines that it's circa 1947, and that there are other slides from that collection that all demonstrate that it's from around that time period. And then when you look at the actual body contained as far as within the image, and no matter how many scientists tell you that it's not human, well, but when a viable solution comes up, and it's determined to be something very conventional, very prosaic, obviously you have to accept that. And in my case, no one is ever going to find where Don Schmidt said that this is an alien body. And in fact, no one is going to find that.
I just recorded you saying that.
That it was an alien body when I never said that it was.
Yeah.
And that no one is ever going to find that Don Schmidt ever said that this had anything to do with Roswell.
Yeah.
I immediately made that disclaimer, that this has nothing to do with Roswell.
Yeah.
And it was something that I also, I hearken back to with Dr. Hynek, that he always, he would clarify a situation by saying, we're investigating the properties of a phenomenon. And that's what we were doing. And unfortunately, I was surrounded by a number of people that cried smoking gun, cried Holy Grail, before anything was established.
Yeah.
And at the end, it came down to, Don, stand with us on this because we know we're correct. We know it's true.
Yeah.
And that, too, was my mistake.
Yep.
Yeah.
Now, is the one person that was promoting this still claiming that it's alien?
I think they've moved on. I think they're looking for the next alien or the next slide, so to speak.
Yeah.
I did question. I spoke to a number of Indian tribe leaders, and it's something I asked them to at least look into, that if the body has been desecrated, has been disfigured, and if indeed an eye is missing, which I think anybody who's even studied as far as the Old West, that it would be the ultimate desecration of an Indian body, and you'd shoot the eyes out, which would mean that they would then forever wander throughout the earth as far as a spirit, never making it to the happy hunting ground, so to speak. And if in the mutilation of that mummy, that two-year-old boy, if that was part of the desecration, if there would be any outcry in displaying it, putting it out, putting it as far as in a museum, if Indian leaders would have stepped in and said, no, you can't do that. I mean, that's even adding further desecration to this mummified boy. So that was the last thing I asked to check. And not that I deny for a second what it is. I want to be sure. Unlike a lot of, skeptics who just immediately after they find a flaw within the ointment, or fly within the ointment, so to speak, that all bets are off, end of story. I still want to make sure all the pieces of the puzzle fall into place. And not that there's any chance of, redemption or resurrection, so to speak. No, I just want to then be able to say, yes, and we also checked into that. We also looked into that. And so the due process in that regard still continues.
Really? Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you think Hynek would have felt about that whole situation going back to him? Do you think that he just would have shook his head and said, you didn't follow a certain
protocol? Then I would have said, but then Alan, we relied on the likes of you. We relied on the scientific community. Yeah. They're the ones who failed.
Yeah, yeah.
And it wasn't And I don't deny that I worked with a number of colleagues, and keeping in mind that my own partner, Thomas J. Carey, he is an anthropologist. He's just his dissertation away from his PhD in anthropology.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, Tom, and the more questions I would ask him, it always came down to, well, Don, do you trust me? And I had to bow to his experience, his profession. And so...
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, like you said, it's a move on type of situation. You have to move when something like this happens. There's been failures all along, and you know, in the field.
Every walk of life, in every science, it's no different than you have a shuttle explode on you, and what do you do? And you know, we've held NASA to the fire. When you think about, and I was the first one, and one of the used to be on our board of directors at the Center for UFO Studies, and he was an engineer, worked at Johnson Control in Houston, and he was there at the time of the Challenger explosion. And I would even bring up to him at a board meeting, you know, a plane can crash, and the next plane, they board, you know, the next set of people, and they go right back up. And NASA has an accident, and it grounds the entire project for 3 years. So who's being, you know, overly cautious? Who's not willing to put it behind them? Okay, now what don't we repeat, and how do we move forward? So I guess we could do that with the slides as well. But the point being, I immediately tried to disown any connection to Roswell. So in no way should the slides and
it's
keeping...
It's the other people around you, though. And I think that possibly you may have been used to influence that condition. Like, here's a Roswell investigator.
Right.
He's
right
behind the slides. So, you know, kind of, I think, you know, the showmanship and, you know, all that of Jaime, just, it's an unfortunate situation. You're right. I know exactly what you mean about moved on to the next one.
I sat there that evening, and Tom Carey could tell you, why aren't they showing the second slide?
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't they showing the second image?
Yeah.
And then they finally did at the very end. And prior to that, we had only seen condensed. People are of the impression that we had the slides in our possession, that we were the ones that were then able to take them and have them examined and tested and dated and all. No, 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 no. They were never, you know, provided us as far as any such opportunity. We had to rely on scans. The placard, for example, the placard that we saw was clearly doctored. It was a script.
Really?
In fact, I would then ask, why was it that the likes of Dr. David Rudiak and Studio Macbeth, and as far as even a military officer at the Pentagon that we asked to look at this, and they would tell us that even Adobe looked at that placard and nobody was able to decipher a single letter.
Yeah.
And then when we actually saw it, it's like, this isn't block letter. This is block. This isn't script. Who changed that?
Wow.
And even as far as the body, that we always saw it, you know, as far as a tight cropped image. And then when I actually see for the first time in Mexico City the full museum display, and you see the displays in the background, so the next afternoon, I'm in Jaime Masson's office in Mexico City, and I go, Jaime, I want to see the second slide. I want to see it right now. Why do you need to see it, Don? I said, Jaime, I want to see it right now. And so by the time I left from Mexico City, I knew. It was over.
Did you think your, I don't want to say career, but the ufology field, did you think it was over for you? Or how did you feel at that moment?
Only if I allowed it.
Yeah.
Only if I allowed all the naysayers, because I had a lot of, you know, my true friends and colleagues in the field just say, Don, learn from it.
Yeah.
Move forward from it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's something that, as we know, I mean, there are surgeons who lose patients. Mm-hmm. And they could also throw in the towel. And that's life and death.
Yeah.
And the idea that, and again, it wasn't that it was my cop-out, it wasn't my fallback that, well, the scientists are the ones who blew it. No, I blew it. Don Schmidt blew it. I, again, instead of going even by my gut impression, Tom Carey could tell you that that January, just months before the presentation in Mexico City, I wanted the bail. I kept going, Tom, I don't feel right by this. I don't like this. And he, again, Don, stand by me on this. Stand by me on this.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah. Well, I still respect you, and I'm glad that you stuck
thank
with
you.
It. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you. All I will add, Martin, is that just imagine, and I put it this way, imagine if Travis Walton would have his experience today. I think the Internet would rip him to shreds overnight.
Yeah.
I think what's happening nowadays, and I think that's where even Hynek.
Social media, too.
I think even Hynek. I don't know how he would have dealt with it. Because I think the worst of it is, now keeping in mind that he made a major faux pas with just his labeling or explaining away one particular sighting as swamp gas.
Yes.
Amidst a flood of sightings. And he was not able to outlive that. I mean, until the day he died, he was still apologizing for that.
Wow.
So just imagine, as far as with social media today.
Yeah.
So is it any wonder any of us are able to still move forward?
Yeah.
So
well, you know,
we move forward.
Yeah. I get hate mail and trolls and all that on, you know, it depends on where they find me. And it's okay. You know, I mean, I don't feel threatened by it. I just keep moving on because I like what I do, and that's what's important to me. I don't care if someone doesn't like what I do. It's okay. They don't have to listen.
And how much of it is just pettiness and jealousy and the point that you're doing something that maybe they'll never do, and they attack you for it because maybe you're in their way. It's not like, okay, we're all grown-ups here. Let's move on.
Yeah.
As opposed to let's just keep opening up the scab.
Right. Yeah. So going back to Hynek, what do you know about his turning point? Was Socorro part of his turning point?
It was gradual. Mm-hmm. But Socorro was probably the linchpin, was probably as far as the definitive turning point. Because he had to concede that this was a nuts and bolts object that actually touched down. But he was still the good soldier for the Air Force. In fact, Paul Hardin is the Socorro historian. And if you were to go and ask, like, where did all the photographs go? I mean, there were photographs of even the footprints before they were all obscured by some of the original sightseers that came in.
Uh-huh.
So there were the footprints of the, like, 10-year-old child still present at the site.
Wow. So that and was like a sandy area then?
It's a sandy. It's within an arroyo, a lot of brush, but it's within this swill, within this hollow.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there's a dummy site. There's another site that they will take you to. But it's just staged. It's downsite from the original. The true site, only a few people know about. Because the cluster of the stones where the landing gear touched are still there.
Yeah. Still Ray Stanford was there in time.
Precisely. And the point being that because even Lonnie Zamora himself, he was so shook, he was so upset by what he had just seen, by what he just experienced. He didn't go back to the police station. He went right to his parish priest. He thought he experienced something demonic.
That's right.
Yeah.
I've heard that.
And so you have all of these people who were standing with Zamora. And you have then all the photographs. And you talk to the historian. Where did all this go? The newspaper, it was all confiscated by the Air Force. And who was the one who went and confiscated? Alan Hynek. So he was, again, still being the good Air Force consultant. And he did whatever they instructed him to do. And he gathered it all up. And it wasn't like, it's now mine, or I get copies of all this, correct? It was like, no. So nobody ever will see any of this. And that's why it's not part of Blue Book. And that's the sad, you know, the saddest feature in all this, and that Allen stayed with the Air Force because he wanted to have access to the data. But the data was always secondhand. It was always subpar. It was never, as he put it, as I said earlier, the hardcore cases. And Socorro was hardcore. It was as hardcore as it gets. Mm-hmm. And even there, he was robbed. Even there, he wasn't the spokesperson. You won't find any footage of Allen talking about swamp gas there. Yet 2 years later in Michigan, he was.
Hmm. Yeah. Wow. Can you talk about any cases that you worked directly with him on in CUFOS?
There were either Illinois cases or even Wisconsin cases. There was a Port Washington case. There was even a Cedarburg, Wisconsin case. And in those situations, it was us going into the field, investigating the case, tracking down and interviewing all the witnesses, and then providing the final report to Dr. Hynek. The last case was just across the border, just north of Illinois. And Allen was especially keen on the case because it involved a whole group of elderly people who were outdoors for an evening. And then there was a fire that seemed to develop in the area that the UFO arrived, and the possibility that the UFO caused the grass fire. It all happened, you know, simultaneously. And so he was leaning towards the high unusual, that type of thing. And he would often tell me that what I like about you, Don, is because you even correct me. Because we later determined that it was in the flight that was in the approach path of a private runway, a private pilot, and he smoked, and he would, often he would toss a butt out the window as he would come in, and that's what caused the fire. That even the fire marshal didn't come up with that.
Wow.
And so, and we found, we later found the cigarette butt, that type of thing. And we spent all. And so, and because we were very skeptical. I mean, Allen Hendry was our chief investigator, and he was the consummate skeptic. But that's where Dr. Jalen Hynek relied on us, especially in his latter years. And he would always talk about, he would always comment, I'm an old man in a hurry. And we were afraid because there was a mystical part of Dr. Hynek in that he even suggested well, we need to get even magicians and psychics involved. Because how can people be fooled? Like when the amazing Kreskin did this group hypnosis at some presentation up in Canada, and Dr. Hynek was present. And Kreskin, at Allen's bequest, demonstrated that I could hypnotize an entire audience to believe that with a particular trigger, they all will just start describe UFOs. And they did. They went outside. They were all glancing up at the sky, and he rang a bell or something, and one by one, they were all, describing UFOs. So that's where Dr. Hynek, this idea of even mass hallucination and even, psychic projection and trickery, magic, that type of thing. Hmm. And I think, and Dr. Hynek always relied on us to always kind of pull him back, that we still, we need something. As another investigator said, that you can go across the street and kick the tires.
Yeah.
Because that's the only thing that's going to demonstrably prove that we're dealing with an actual phenomenon.
Right. So you knew him throughout the last part of his life. And when he passed away, you mentioned going through some notes. What kind of a situation was that? Were you able to, was it Mimi, did you say, his wife?
Yes.
Was she
Well, she remained in agreeable? Scottsdale. This was where you had the Lindheimer Observatory on Lake Michigan. And Allen stored a lot of his files there. And Dr. Mark Rodiger and former board member Mark Chesney Roediger and Chesney were childhood friends. And they went through, they went to the Lindheimer Observatory hoping that Alan had stashed away a lot of even old Blue Book cases that weren't part of the declassified Blue Book files from 1977, that type of thing. And according to Roediger and Chesney, somebody had rifled through, you know, the observatory. Hmm. Everything was trashed.
Jeez.
And I didn't doubt them. I just thought, wow, you mean somebody actually beat you, beat us to the punch, so to speak? And they were, well, yes, somebody actually, you know, had rifled through the file cabinets.
You know, I'm not usually, or I don't think I'm a conspiratorial type guy, but that sure sounds like a conspiracy to me. Like government and, possibly.
And considering who you know. We were dealing with, now, Alan Hynek had a top security clearance with the Air Force all those years. Mm-hmm. And we often question whether he had one till the day he died, if he had signed a non-disclosure, for example. Mm-hmm. And they kept him on a tight leash. In his latter, the last year or two of Blue Book, he was, you know, he was cooperating more and more with his own scientific colleagues. He was lecturing more and more. He was, you know, doing more and more television. He was doing Merv Griffin and Tom Snyder and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And so I think they realized that we got a loose cannon here, that now he's going to, you know, he's going to become the conduit. People are going to come to him. I mean, we have essentially, you know, closed the curtain on our involvement. Why should we expect anybody to come to the Air Force any longer? And so it caused us often to wonder if Hynek was still connected to some degree. And I think that's why we hope to find all types of, you know, secret documents. And they weren't to be found. We found those handwritten notes regarding Roswell witnesses. We found some other documents, you know, back to the early 50s that suggested that they were concerned about, like, the CIA and the whole Robertson panel taking over the project. And I know Dr. Jacques Vallée, you know, believed that that would suggest that there was another project underway at that time. And I know Dr. Roediger and Dr. Hynek's secretary, Jenny Zeidman, who was with him from Ohio State, and then thereafter, that they investigated that, and they found, you know, no reason to believe that. So if anything, we were able to demonstrate that as much as they may have watched, even from a distance, that Alan Hynek was still an old man in a hurry. That he felt he was hard-pressed to come up with some answers at the end. And personally, he died very bitter, very broken. Mm-hmm. I think he truly expected that he would have a courier or he'd get a phone call at the least at the end and would say, Alan, you were correct. You knew. But we couldn't tell you. We couldn't confide to you till now. But Godspeed, you know, wherever you go from here, you'll really know the whole story. You never got that.
Wow.
You never received that. And to me, it was often, and early on after Alan passed away, it was like, we got to finish what he started.
Yeah.
That he would want us to finish. Because believe me, Martin, there was a lot of talk initially at KUFOS. How do we go on? Mm-hmm. How do we? And I think the first demonstration was that we renamed the center the J. Alan Hynek Center for UFO Studies.
Mm-hmm.
So we were,
wow.
You know.
Yeah. What is, just we're out of time here basically, but what do you have anything you can say about the man that is kind of unknown, something interesting about his personality, you know, other than UFOs? Or
he had a wonderful sense of humor.
Awesome.
He was a consummate, you know, absent-minded professor, and he joked about it. I mean, he loved the lighter side of the subject matter. Alan Hendry, who, as our chief investigator, was a wonderful artist, often drew Dr. Hynek as far as in compromising positions, even with Men in Black and that type of thing. And Alan just reveled in it. He just relished, you know, the opportunity, you know, the self-infliction as far as that. And there, too, he demonstrated that there's nothing in life so serious that you can't step back and at the least be amused by it, but if not, have a good laugh over it and get over it and then get on with it.
Yeah.
And the point always coming back to, you know, we can always live in the past, but it doesn't get it done. And Alan was always moving forward. Dr. Jalen Hynek always relished and looked forward to the next day and the next case, the next sighting. He listened to the mundane. I mean, he never, you know, turned away anybody. That was the wonderful thing he taught me. And I like to believe that I, too, I hear people, you know, talk about, I just don't understand that. How do you have all this patience? It's because if they feel I'm good enough that they can, you know, express in confidence what they can't get anybody else to talk to. And why would I want to join the legions of people who are going to laugh at them and belittle them and have a laugh at their expense? No.
Yeah, well, I just witnessed that with you in the lobby, with the woman that said, "You've always been so kind to me and listened to me."
Well, I didn't realize you caught.
I did catch
that,
yeah.
So thank you. Thank you.
So, Donald, as always, it's been a real pleasure, and thank you so much.
Well, I went quickly, Martin, and I, again, thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.
Absolutely.
All right, so that was it for Don Schmidt. Now, our next guest is coming up. And her name is Alice Druffel. She's the daughter of the famed UFO researcher and author, Anne Druffel. She's also an environmental advocate and a classical singer. It's a great interview. As I said in the beginning, we're going to be talking about her mother, Anne Druffel, what it was like growing up in a childhood home of someone so unique as Anne Druffel. Also, James McDonald. We're going to be talking a lot about him. Another very heartfelt interview that I'm very happy about. So hang in there. We'll be right back with Alice Druffel. All right, I'm here with Alice Druffel. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And you have a distinguished mother and very well known in the UFO field.
I do, a distinguished mother, Anne Druffel.
Yes.
And I was happy to be asked to the UFO Congress to present on her behalf. And I wish that I could do a somewhat Get Out parody and take her brain and put it in my head just for that hour, but I wasn't able to because she has an encyclopedic memory of all the UFO cases she's worked on and heard about, and written, investigated.
Now, what got her started in the very beginning? What sparked her interest in the whole field?
In 1945, when she was still a young girl, she saw something over Long Beach. She was coming home from school, and right before she went into the house, she saw this big, huge craft in the sky. She did not know what it was. She was almost transfixed by it. And she states that it stayed there for about an hour and a half. Now, this was just before the end of World War II. So she thought it had something to do at first with an aircraft related to the war effort.
Mm-hmm.
But the more she stared at it, the more she understood that it did not. And the funny thing is it stayed in the sky for an hour and a half. She even called her mother over to look at it. And my grandmother was a very kind of serious, you know, studied person. And she came out and she said, "Oh, it's a weather balloon." And she went back, and my mother said it was not a weather balloon. And she called her mother to come back and look at it, and her mother said, "I have to cook dinner for your father." So she stared at it for about an hour and a half, and then she said it seemed to eject many other small things, as if this had been kind of like a mothership.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happened, she just got very, very scared and went into the house. But that was the beginning of her interest. But she was interested in astronomy. She wanted to study astronomy in college. And she was told by the teachers, oh, that's not a subject that women study.
Isn't
so
that awful?
She was, wow. Yeah, unfortunately. But she was interested in astronomy her whole life, and she became somewhat of an amateur astronomer.
Mm-hmm.
She built her own telescope. And
built her own telescope?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Wow.
And so she was always telling us things in the sky, and that's what made her a wonderful researcher as well. She could explain away 90% of the cases when people called, because she knew the sky so well, and she knew the position of the stars and the planets.
And what was the, for the body of the research that she did, like a time, you know, from 1960-something to, well, I mean, what was the timeline and how long she researched?
I would say it was a good 50 years.
Wow.
I'm thinking mid-60s. She became involved with NICAP before mm-hmm. it was unfortunately disbanded. And she wrote about 200 articles in various news publications.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And what is some of the cases? Now, before I finish that thought, I was speaking earlier with Don Schmidt, and I asked him, did Alan Hynek know anything about Roswell ahead of time? You know, ahead of, when I say ahead of time, ahead of that time when it came out, so to speak, when, you know, Stanton Friedman, you know, found out all the information and, you know, the book came out after. A lot of people never remembered Roswell. And she started in the 60s, of course, that's much later in the 1947. But had that subject ever come up, that the Army Air Force said that they captured a disc, and was that just forgotten?
No, that was still very much in the minds of people. So, of course, she wasn't there originally to study it, mm-hmm. but we grew up hearing about this. And
wow.
There were so many, you know, news reports, the movies, the shows about Roswell. And my mother was fascinated with that, though she never really investigated herself. But when you ask my mother, Mom, do you believe in UFOs? She would say, I want to see a body or I want to see a craft before I will definitely say yes to that.
Wow.
But she heard all of the tales of Roswell. Just as a side note on Roswell, I know a woman who's at my church, and she grew up in Roswell, New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
But she was born like around 1945. But she swears that there was an undertaker in town, and that at the time that the Roswell sighting happened, this person was called to provide three small caskets to the Roswell Air Force Base.
Now, has she talked about this to someone like Don Schmidt or other people that investigated? Because this may be some type of cooperation, because mm-hmm. I think there are some people that are skeptical about that claim. Mm-hmm. How did she know about that in particular? Was it hearsay, or did she know? Do you know anything more about that in detail?
I understand that she grew up knowing that. She had heard it from family members.
Hmm.
And she is a very, very valid, credible person. She would have no reason to make up a fabrication. Now,
right.
I don't know if she was repeating something that was correct, but she would say yes, that this happened according to what she heard.
Mm-hmm. So I heard you say today that you're one of five girls in your family?
Yes.
How was growing up in a family known to be interested in UFOs?
It was very interesting. I think I had a lot of experiences that, you know, the average person did not have.
Mm-hmm.
So I can remember very clearly being a child And since I was the youngest, I was the one who often answered the phone. So around Saturday night, we'd all be sitting around, and I was, I would say 7, 8, 9 years old. The phone would ring. I would have to pick it up. And I very clearly remember once I said, hello, and a man said, hey, man, I just saw little green aliens in my back in my backyard. I was like, okay. And I'm like, I think you want to speak to my mother. So oftentimes we would, you know, cover the phone. We'd say, it sounds like another one. And then there were other people who would call, and, you know, they seemed very credible.
So was your mother known as the person to call?
Yes.
From what region, your general region, and how did people know to call her?
So her being part of MUFON LA and Skynet, her name and number was given to people who would call the Los Angeles Department, Police Department, or people who would call the Griffith Observatory. If they say that they reported something in the sky, she was often top on the list to call. But there were other field investigators that would be called as well. But she would often be called. Wow. And this was, you know, as I remember, 60s, 70s, 80s. And then she was active for as a field investigator for probably at least 40 years.
What are some of the dynamic cases that she worked on?
I would say one of the most dynamic cases that she worked on was the Rex Heflin photos.
Wow.
So in August of 1965, a highway maintenance engineer, Rex Heflin, saw a craft in the sky.
He had Polaroid on him, right?
He did.
Yeah.
He saw it in Santa Ana, and he just so happened to have a Polaroid camera in his work truck. And he took 4 pictures, which ended up being some of the earliest and clearest legitimate pictures of a UFO ever seen. Investigators had always made sure that they wanted some kind of proof. They wanted a picture. They wanted the close encounters of the second kind thing. But a clear picture was really, really very important. And there weren't that many up to that point. And Rex Heflin actually saw this. This was August 3rd, 1965. And so the first 3 photos show a craft, and then the 4th photo shows the remains of a craft.
Like he said, smoke or something.
Like a smoke ring that Rex Heflin said was about 4 times the size of the original craft that he had seen. And what was interesting about this was that there were people from the U.S., the Marines, the U.S. Army, the Air Force, that came by to borrow these pictures. And he obligingly lent out the pictures to anyone who showed interest. And it was the first 3 pictures that he always lent out, because there was very little said about the 4th picture. But in September of 65, which just 3 months after this incident, a man who claimed he was from NORAD came to his door, borrowed the pictures. Heflin just expected that they would be returned just like all the others had been returned. But that was the last time he saw the first 3 photos until 1993. And so for almost 40 years, researchers did not have the original first 3 pictures to work with. And a lot of them were working with, you know, second, third, and fourth generation copies. And it was really difficult to make, true research from third, fourth generation copies.
Sure.
So, and then the story of their return is interesting. So Rex Heflin worked as a highway maintenance engineer for 30 years. And then he developed this lead poisoning, unfortunately, because he worked with highways and roadways so much. And then he moved up to Santa Rosa. Well, one day in 1993, there was a telephone call. And he answered, a woman said, have you checked your mailbox lately? And he said no, but he went out, and there was nothing in his mailbox. Half an hour later, the woman called back and said, have you checked your mailbox lately?
Did he ask who it was, and did they say who they were?
He didn't. at least if he did, there was no story there. But he went to his mailbox, and there were the first three photos. And they were the originals, because it had all of his original markings. Wow. And they were returned. They were relatively unharmed. It seems like someone for the past almost 40 years had taken very good care of them.
That is so strange that they would bother to return them.
Yes, that's right. Oh, it's actually almost 30 years, excuse me.
Yeah. That's still very strange.
So the question is, why were they returned?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like it would be just as easy if they were gone so long and, you know, 30 years, most people are going to forget about them for the most part.
Exactly. But it was really good because in those ensuing years, James McDonald, an atmospheric scientist from the University of Arizona, had declared publicly that he did not see that photo number 4 with the smoke ring was related to the first three photos. Because in the first three photos, it seemed to show that there was like a flat clouds in the sky. But in the fourth photo, there were like cumulus clouds. And James McDonald was an atmospheric scientist. And so he didn't say, Rex, you're lying. He just said, I can't figure this out. And
unless it was a different part of the sky, is it possible there could be different type of clouds?
It was. It was the first one was taken out through his window.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the second and third was taken through the passenger window. And then the third was taken from outside you know, staring at a different part of the sky. But in 1993, Rex thought, you know, I want to have another reanalysis of these photos. So that's when he reached out to Ann Druffel and Bob Wood and another researcher from CSUN. They did this whole entire reanalysis. They got a grant for this. They did mathematical calculations of how you know, far it was, the distance and everything. And the photo 3 was really great, because when they reanalyzed photo 3, they found a smoke trail coming out of it, as if the object was starting to starting to have a smoke ring emerge. So those photo 3 and 4 were shown to be conclusively linked by that.
Isn't that something?
One had that in the 1960s.
Wow. Now, have you physically held these photos in your hand?
I have.
You have? Wow.
I have, yes.
And where are they now?
Rex Heflin entrusted my mother with them. So they're in Pasadena.
They're
in Pasadena in a safe. My mother bought a special safe 15 years ago, put them in the safe, and about 2 months ago, I said, Mom, we have those Rex Heflin photos around here, don't we? She's like, yeah. So there was the safe. We found the key, and we held them for the first time. It was quite exciting.
Isn't that something? Now, I've talked to a number of UFO researchers as far as, you know, important documents. For instance, you know, Travis Walton has letters from Betty Hill. There are Blue Book files that were found by a gentleman in Ohio that were basically sold on Craigslist. There's a lot of documents now. I know Klaus Svahn in Sweden, they have a great archive. They have a great way to store things. But I think there's a lot of relevant documents, papers, and books that need to be preserved, you know, including, you know, images like this and other great images. But it's exciting because, let's just say, down the road, 50 years from now, where are those photos going to be? Is there a plan? Do you know?
That's right. No, actually, in my talk today, I said, we're going to have to find a place for my mother's UFO files. And I'm sure that's on her mind as well.
Mm-hmm.
When I was going through her filing cabinets, oh my goodness, it's like a treasure trove there. The photos, the
wow.
original interviews. She has tape recordings of witnesses.
This sounds like a documentary to me in the making.
Right. Well, and I don't know if this is a good time to go to James McDonald, because I could tell you a little bit.
Yes,
about,
I'd like to. A man that's always fascinated me, and, you know, with a tragic ending. But someone that was really bringing a lot of credibility.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, so I'd like to talk about, did you ever meet him? Did your mother ever meet James?
Yes, my mother met James several times. So James McDonald, an atmospheric scientist from the University of Arizona at Tucson, he was also professor of meteorology, and he did a lot with weather modification and cloud physics. He was very, very well known in his field, very prolific. He had the type of mind that I hear from several researchers that just went constantly. Just one of those people, searching, asking questions, searching, getting answers, going to hear from here. It seems like sometimes when you hear him talk, I think his mind worked faster than his mouth could produce the words.
Mm-hmm.
But very, very brilliant man. And he became very excited by the subject of UFOs and started researching UFOs in Arizona.
Do you happen to know what made him get interested in it? Because of his study of atmospheric?
I wish I knew the answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
I would direct people to my mother's book, Firestorm.
Well, that's it for the free show. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, you can listen to the full shows for free. All you have to do is go to podcastufo.com every Wednesday night at 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Or you can support the show so I can do things like go to Phoenix and other things like that, and also pay for the costs of the show, which it is rather costly per month. For $2 or more a month, you can help us out at podcastufo.com. Thanks so much, and we'll be back next week with an Italian ufologist going to be talking about researching and his book on Italy and UFOs. We'll be back at the regular time next week with a live show, and thanks so much for listening. Remember to keep your eyes to the sky.